Hello and welcome, listeners, to ION EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hi, Chelsea. I'm so excited to speak with you today. As you know, I'm a huge fan of the Wellness Center and all the work that you do.
Well, thanks, Avna. We're a fan of you as well, so feelings mutual.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're the wellness coordinator.
I sure am.
Good, I got it. Bonus points to me. So what does that mean? What does it mean to be a wellness coordinator?
Well, good question. And it might be interesting for some of your audience as well, because I just celebrated my actually 17th anniversary of being the wellness coordinator here at TRU. And prior to March 2020, I was the, in terms of roles of wellness representation on campus, it was sort of my role. But what's great is that, so I was kind of overviewing campus wellness, so employee wellness, student wellness. The last 4 or 5 years in particular before March 2020 was really targeted more to students, which kind of left a gap for employee wellness because I'm part-time. I'm a what they call a bipartite faculty member, which means I do my professional role for 80% of my job and then 20% is service. So like giving back on community committees or national committees and things like that. But in March 2020, they did hire someone in people and culture called a campus wellness advisor. So some people might see, oh, people and culture have wellness things going on. What's the wellness center? What's the difference? So I guess the difference is my role now is primarily student facing. However, within that is that we are a campus community. So the way that students and employees communicate, work together, you know, faculty in the classroom. So we're a bit of a symbiotic sort of relationship. And so it's important that we as a campus stay well. I'm not sure if that describes what I do. I can speak specifically if you want to know kind of the things that I do in my role. But overall, my primary role is health promotion and illness prevention at a population level. So the population of students on campus.
That actually sounds really similar to public health nursing to me.
It is similar. However, they do some like clinical type of skills. So they will be like when I worked as a public health nurse, for example, it was my first nursing job was, you know, immunization certification. So you're giving immunizations, you're doing well baby visits and you're following like kind of higher risk families. So I'm not in terms of doing the traditional type of like nursing, because I'm a nurse, it's my background, nursing skill type things. I'm doing all the education, health promotion, illness prevention work to increase the literacy for students and then employees as well on campus.
I think it's just an incredibly important work that we do, because I think at university, at least from a student perspective, and I'm sure from a faculty perspective as well, there's a lot of pressure to succeed and to do more and just to be high functioning. And I think sometimes in the mixed wellness can get lost. What exactly does the Wellness Center do? So you work as like promoting those health and services.
Exactly. So if we look at the kind of, yeah, if we look at the Wellness Center as like an umbrella, if we look at the umbrella things that we do, so we have a physical center now. So we've always had a center. I was just saying before we started the call, I was cleaning up my storage unit because, as I said, I've been here for 17 years. Well, the first 10 years, I moved 7 times. So I've been in, or sorry, 10 times in 7 years. So I have been in 11 different locations. But in October 2019, we opened our doors to a much like more accessible, bigger, brighter, more usable space for students. So this year with COVID, we're going to be navigating some uncharted territory, like all of us will be, in terms of how the space will function, how many students we can have in the center. But to give you an idea, pre-COVID, those 6 months from October till March we were open, we had over 6,200 drop-ins to our space. And so students would come to our space and we look at kind of why they came. We track that, those type of things for our stats. Some of them come to talk to a peer. So we have a student wellness ambassador team. I'll talk about that in a second, but for one-to-one peer support. Some of them just come to hang out and have tea. Some of them come because they're looking for resources on a specific health topic. Some of them come and hang out on the beanbags outside and just chill with their buddies. We did this with our new renovation. We have a quiet slash nap room. So students were coming to like, you know, just have a quiet, calming space. And then also some just to have a sleep and have a rest. And they set their timers and it's a no tech zone. And we had the lights dimmed. And so if students needed a rest, like who doesn't need a cat nap at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when you're a student, right? So
question. You could come.
Yeah.
How did you set those timers? Because I've never been inside the nap room.
Well, they just would set their own timer, say their phone, or they would ask us. hey, and if we had a student working, they would help, you know, set the timer and wake them up. So just because, you know, they didn't want to sleep past the day to class or something like that. So they might ask as a backup.
That's what my fear was. I know.
A
very loud alarm to wake me up. And it wakes up half my house, all my house, and probably the neighbors too. So I was like,
yeah,
people wake up.
I know. But so that's kind of our overarching. So we have a space. We have amazing, and we all love it, our coloring wall. So we have like a wall that if you just to de-stress, you can come in and sit and just color and just kind of like be present in that mindful moment. We have, so that's kind of the one, the wellness center. And then in terms of like our outreach activities. So for me as a coordinator, I do one-to-one health consultations with students. So I'm not a counselor. That's why I say health consultations. So if students have a question about, say, they have maybe mild stress or their overall wellness, sleep, nutrition, sexual health, they have questions about maybe they're using tobacco, or they have questions about substance use, they can come and book a one-to-one appointment with me. That's probably the smallest portion of my work because, as I mentioned, I kind of focus on the population level because we do have counselors, we have the early alert program, we have case managers, we have accessibility services advisors who do a lot of that one-to-one support of students. So we're looking at kind of that broader health education support. So we do workshops, either going into classrooms or virtually into classrooms and delivering workshops on wellness-related topics. Or we coordinate campus-wide initiatives in terms of some workshops, but also things like Bell Let's Talk Day, our annual consent tea. We're doing something for National Addictions Awareness Week. We do our Bladder Chatter newsletter, which you said you had just seen to remind you March 2020 was the last time. We publish a paper version, but you can find those. And I think we have now up to about 24 washrooms on campus. And we're normally it was a monthly student wellness newsletter. We're hoping it will be twice a month. As we launch this year, we'll also be publishing those digitally on our social media pages. Then also, as I mentioned, the Student Wellness Ambassador team. So I oversee and mentor students who support the Wellness Center about 6 hours a week. So by working in the center, as I mentioned, or helping deliver some of those campus outreach events. And, you know, because really in terms of being student facing, we need to have student voice to what we do. It's really important. And then I'm not a researcher in terms of, I was faculty level. As I mentioned, I'm a bipartite faculty. So my service and my professional role, but I do some research. So for example, we participated 3 times in the National College Health Assessment, which gives us a bit of a snapshot of student self-reported health beliefs, behaviors, and practices. So ranging from like sleep, stress, sexual health, overall wellness, mental health, et cetera. And then of course, as for anyone who knows me, if there's anything about wellness, I'm there to advocate and hopefully increase people's access and reducing barriers to services on campus. And one example of that is in 2017, I became the TRU take-home naloxone site coordinator for the BC Centre for Disease Control. So that means that because I'm a regulated health professional as a registered nurse, I liaise with the BC Centre for Disease Control in order to provide training and education about substance use and take-home naloxone. So we train people in take-home naloxone. And one cool thing that I do is that I actually do a train-the-trainer with the ambassadors. And so they themselves can actually teach people how to use take-home naloxone and provide that education. So that's a bit of a like a snapshot sort of the things that we do. Yeah, that's a long story, but we do a lot. We're very busy and we're really here to support student success. And we know that when students feel like you mentioned, Emma, sometimes their wellness gets pushed to the side a bit because universities are high stress environments. But what we know is that for those students who have the coping skills and resiliency to make it through, they tend to be more successful personally and academically. So their wellness is really key and integral to their success as a student.
So I've been thinking a lot about this and just in preparation for speaking with you. And because as a nursing student myself, we think about health and wellness all the time. And I think it's what sets us apart from more, say doctors per se, it's that we think of the person as a whole and their well-being. And so I was thinking I can speak from a student's perspective on like what wellness means, mm-hmm. but what would you say, like, what does wellness mean when it comes to students? Like, are we like healthy physically or like, what is wellness?
That is like the $1 million question, Amna, because honestly, I've been in this role for a long time and everything is wellness. So I think you all know, and you know, one of the things I did this spring was I know that our AVP of students and Dean of Faculty of Student Development, Christine Adam, is doing some consultations around like the future state of desired wellness and what we want, where we want to move to. And actually Hannah Conradi, one of our student wellness ambassadors, had said to me, hey, Chelsea, can you like write down for me like what your definition is of wellness? And that was 2 weeks ago and I haven't done it yet because I'm like, it's so broad. And I think for me, it's like how, what I'm learning in terms of like, really we're talking, I know this focuses on EDI today, is looking at some, we have Western models of what wellness might look like, and especially as a nurse. But also, what are some of the indigenous perspectives or different cultural perspectives of what wellness is? And I just want to say, like, wellness will be different for every person. And so I think that's where you talk about like the individuality of students, is meeting students where they're at on their wellness journey is really important, because what might be really, you know, they're working on their wellness, maybe something different than I'm working on with my wellness. But for me, I would say and that's how I think we approach it in wellness, is that we recognize and understand that there's different perspectives. I will, though, however, say what guides my practice in this field are different frameworks. So obviously looking at the social determinants of health. So looking at things like employment and income, racism, gender, you know, income and equity, you know, those are really important factors that have a bigger impact on someone's health and wellness than, you know, eating enough vegetables and exercising enough. And we know that, right, in terms of this health field. And so that's what underpins my practice. Looking at intersectionality also impacts my practice. And so that means that looking at people who potentially face oppression based on your identity. So for example, if you face racism, or say I was using this as an example when I was doing this presentation for Faculty of Student Development, if you happen to be a woman, for example, you will tend to experience sexualized violence at a higher rate than someone of a different gender, like say a male, if we're looking at male and female. However, if you are identify as a female who's a lesbian, you actually have a higher rate of experiencing sexualized violence. And if you're an Indigenous woman, you'll also then again experience. And so when you look at people's identities as they overlap, as they experience different levels of oppression, they tend to experience like adverse or maybe negative health outcomes at a higher rate than those. So it kind of goes back to a privilege as well. So that also, when I look at my practice, that's really important for me to understand those complexities of people's identities and how they experience health, how they experience healthcare. And in terms of, I mentioned a bit earlier about like the, you know, decolonizing and Indigenous wellness pieces. And that's really a journey that my very first nursing public health job in 2003, I took a maternity leave in, which just makes me really sad to talk about it, but Lytton, Ashcroft, Cache Creek and Spence's Bridge, which I worked a lot with Indigenous communities there for a lot of community members who, lived off reserve would come and like get baby. Well, I would, you know, do baby visits or do immunization clinics. And so that was kind of my first role in working with Indigenous communities, like officially. And so it's been a journey of learning and unlearning a lot in terms of my role. And so what I'm really excited about this year, last year, we really worked with an elder to help kind of guide some of our practices around wellness. And even just thinking about how to start decolonizing what we do, how we do it, those types of things. And I'm really excited that we're going to be starting an Elder in the Wellness Center program this year. We're piloting it. I'd asked back in the spring in March if we could get that, because for me, that's another way to show I value Indigenous ways of knowing in wellness. And so, and also as a way to decolonize the practices that we, you know, tend to be siloed. So, and it's not to negate, and it's really, I mean, I'm so grateful that we have an Elder in Capulkton program, Elder in the House program. But I'm just, if we want to decolonize and really break down some silos, it would be awesome for non-Indigenous students who don't access that particular space to also learn from an elder. And so those are the things, I mean, those are kind of like specific examples, but obviously health promotion frameworks guide my practice, cultural safety and how to be culturally safe in terms of meeting people where they're at. And I think it's just a process that we're continually learning and improving. Definitely since I started here 17 years ago, we've come a long way. I'll just say that.
You know, you mentioned the social determinants of health, and it made me think of a class that I'd taken. I'm completely going off a different train of thought that I had originally, but you mentioned the social determinants of health, and it made me think of a class that I'd taken, the Indigenous health course. I took it with Sheila Blackstock, who was amazing. Cool. And we went over to the Indigenous determinants of health. I found those so fascinating because it's one of those things where we know they're social determinants of health, but when you categorize them with different communities, you really start understanding how one thing that you might think is a positive change or something that you're trying to do that you think is, no, well, this is how it should be, is actually like, oh no, hey, I'm missing a whole population here that I should be supporting as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the thing about wellness is sometimes there's a lot of bias and judgment about people's behavior and choices, for example. And we just have to, I think, take a step back. And really at the end of the day, when we look at changing health and improving health, we actually need to look at changing policies and systems. Those are the biggest impacts of changing people's health. Those individual pieces are important too. But, you know, if you are eating all your fruits and veggies and you're getting lots of sleep, but when you go to access your healthcare provider, you face racism, it negates the positive impacts of those things. Absolutely. So, you know, and so it's really important as a health professional myself that I'm really constantly aware of those things.
We've been talking a lot about, you and I together now, about wellness and what student wellness means. And some of the common themes that in my experience have come up is things like mental health, well-being, physical well-being, of course, that's sleep and your fruits and vegetables. Uh-huh. But what I was, just as we were speaking, what I really came up with, I'm not sure if this is a real term, if it is, someone please let me know, but just like racial well-being. And I don't know if this is a real term. I think I'm coming up with it right now, but if it is, I'm sorry to whoever's idea I'm ruining. But I just thought, because racial well-being, in terms of what I mean by this, is like feeling safe and secure in who you are without facing that racism, because racism is really a healthcare issue. Because everything is health. Your interactions with people impact your health, the way you function in the world or the services you're provided. It's all about your health. Like, people are living beacons of health. Like, that's just what we are. We're just pillars. We're just health. And when you experience racism, or especially microaggressions, those are my nemesis on earth. They kind of pile up and pile up and pile up. And it, even if it doesn't, it's just, it affects your health and well-being, especially your wellness. And so it just made me think, I wonder if racial well-being is an actual thing.
Well, I think it's interesting. And I think maybe that's like, as a nursing student, maybe that's an area of research or, you know, interest.
I think I'd like to explore it, to be honest now. Yeah. I'm not sure if this is a real thing. So if anyone listening knows this exists, so just please do let me know.
Well, I mean, definitely, as we said, like, racism is a social determinant of health, which is like, you know, I'll share this with you. And as part of the presentation, I was looking, we applied for a grant last year, Kyra Garson and I. Unfortunately, they didn't really, it went mostly to community agencies and not post-secondaries, but we were looking at a diversity grant for wellness and trying to encourage like intercultural ambassadors and other like the wellness ambassadors to work together. So I was doing some research for that. And what it talked about was that how racism really like creates health inequities in terms of like negative physical and mental health outcomes for individuals who experience racism. And I just want to share with you, I found this research study from 2015 that was a kind of a meta-analysis, and they looked at over 1,100 articles that all focused on racism as a social determinant of health that were published like the earliest time available to 2013. And when they looked at the criteria for the study, about 333 of those articles met the criteria. And basically they found like the overall theme, of course, was that racism was strongly linked with poor mental health outcomes, including depression, anxiety, and psychological stress. So for those people who experience racism. So like you said, what is the opposite of that? Like, if we look at a capacity building or a strengths-based model, maybe that's what we're needing to look at in terms of, what did you say, racialized wellness? I'm not sure how you phrased it.
I just said racial well-being. Because
racial well-being.
Yeah, because it's like your ability to exist as a racialized person of really, I think, again, I'm going to say like every race, because anytime you're in a minority situation or there is a hierarchy of power, there is always that potential for, you know, marginalization. And it really makes me think, like, how do we get to a place where I can exist as a person the way I look without having that extra burden on my health? Because it really does. It makes me anxious, and then I get sad, and then I don't want to do my schoolwork. Or someone will say something, you know, it affects all aspects of your health and being. So that's kind of, this is an epiphany that really just came to me right now. But
Well, there you go, Emna. There's maybe there's a, like I said, maybe that's a nursing project for your leadership and health promotion in third and fourth year, is looking at that racial wellness.
Yeah, maybe that's
there
what
you go. You're starting something good here. Unless, like you said, unless it's out there, but I think there's always room for learning more.
Right. Or until I get to third year, if someone else has done this, and I'll be sad because it'll take my epiphany. But anyways, I've been like just seeing at the initiatives and the work that you've been doing at the Wellness Center, and I can see how you've been engaging in anti-racism work. But what I like about it is that it doesn't always seem like you're doing stuff, but it's behind the scenes, and it's like that systematic change that you put in by reviewing different models of learning, for example, like you said, or thinking about the different populations that are coming inside. So I really just love that it's not necessarily always like really out loud, but it's always there. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to work towards, is that racism and anti-racism work isn't just like a banner to hold. Mm-hmm. It's like something that you really need to embed into your work all the time, which is what I love about the Wellness Center. You're welcome. I really do love the Wellness Center, in case you haven't figured that out yet.
I'm feeling the love. I can feel it through the screen here.
It's very beautiful too. It's very beautifully decorated, which is always important to me. The aesthetics matter the most. So I was thinking, like, what kinds of barriers did you experience when you were making those changes or trying to make changes? Where did the journey start? Like, when did you realize the center needed to be more racially or ethnically, et cetera, inclusive?
Of course, we all can do better, but I'm generally a pretty inclusive person just by nature of who I am. Like, if you ask any of my friends, I'm the one that's the social connector, obviously. Like, I'm the one that's like, let's go do this. So I like people to feel safe. I like people to feel loved and accepted. You know, it's interesting, Amna, because like in high school, when I was in grade 10, so I would have been just turned 17, I think, 1992. Oh my gosh, I'm super old, everybody who's listening. I was super lucky. They had this thing called CATS, the Canadian Academic Travel Service. And they had these like awesome grants, because it was like trying to create relationships between like Western Canada and the Pacific Rim. So like, you know, in terms of like communicate trade and all this stuff. And so they had these grants where students in high school applied, and they selected like Princeton, where I grew up, Merritt, like Lillooet, Lytton, Spence's Bridge, whether maybe Williams Lake. So like a lot of small communities. So I think there was 40 of us as students who all got to go. So I got to go to Thailand and Hong Kong for 2 weeks. And I think for myself, like I grew up in a single parent home and in somewhat of a, what I thought was poverty, right? And when I traveled there, and it was like really, I don't want to say a culture shock, because it wasn't a culture shock. When you actually, I'm a very empathetic person, when you see people whose homes are basically like a metal roof on a, with a few sticks on the side of a road, and that's where they actually live every single day, you start to think about your privilege, and you start to think about like how people experience life differently than you. And like, you know, so that was kind of my first thinking about the cultural importance and differences, right, around privilege, and not knowing the term really privilege at that point when I was 17. And I think like carrying that through, you know, in 2002, in terms of my own learning as a nursing student, I was once again had the amazing opportunity to go to Nepal for a third year practicum. It was amazing for CP3. Yeah. I mean, you and I could have a whole podcast about what I learned in that. So I won't bore you, but it was like, and I just wrote a story about it for this influencers book or article that they're putting together for TRU. And I was like in my dining room crying, remembering like just the disparities in health. And I'm going to cry now talking to you. I didn't know I was going to like get teary with you today, Emna, but this is like, this is me, because this is who I am. But
I should have told you, but we're very, we're very focused on being trauma informed, because racism, I think, is a form of trauma, and all these, like all the learning curves in between create a lot of anxiety and emotion. Mm-hmm. So crying is totally accepted on this podcast.
Oh yeah. But it's just for me putting myself back in that space where you see the disparities in health based on like poverty and race and status, or like privilege and in within societies, right? So that kind of a foundation that's kind of always been in the back, you know, the background of my mind and thinking about it, and you know, talking to friends who experience racism and what it's been like for them, and But in starting in wellness, it's interesting because, like you said, it needs to be integrated in all that you do. And so I think as I learned and grew in the role, like, for example, I was like, yes, we had this committee back. I don't even remember when I've been here for so long, but like, we need to focus, like, probably in the I started 2004. So probably 2005, 2006-ish, you know, let's celebrate March 31st is like anti-racism, elimination of racial discrimination day. So we did those events. So specifically focused and targeted on that. But over time, as you start to really look at, like I said, the social determinants of health and recognizing that a person's wellness is more holistic and based on a lot of systemic factors. And as we grew our wellness space, because for the first probably 10 years, I didn't really have a space for students that was accessible. So like I was sort of like the mobile wellness center. We didn't start the peer of the student wellness ambassador team until 2015. So that's kind of a new program. So I think really having a more usable space, and then where you're seeing students more frequently and engaging in those kind of conversations. And then you're training leaders in order to be able to respond at a one-to-one level with students. It really became necessary for us to really embed this learning in certain parts of our training. So actually one of the trainings I do with all the leaders since the beginning is the certified peer educator training. And within that, it talks about identities and social identities and constructs of identities and how we treat people based on their identity and how we have biases about people's identity. And then also, you know what I mean? So we kind of started having these conversations and then I also was a former colleague of mine who was one of our counselors who's no longer here. We started this group at work. So I went, when I turned 40, which was in 2016, I took this year of 40 leave and it was amazing. So talking about walking my own wellness talk, I'm privileged. I was able to do it. So I have to acknowledge my own privilege in that. But when I came back, it was amazing because Faculty of Student Development hired a lot of new kind of young professionals. We started this group called, Are You Down With AOP? Are You Down With Anti-Oppressive Practice? Ooh, and yeah, so it was super cool. So like Kyra was involved in that and some other colleagues. And so we would, you know, read some articles about privilege. That was kind of like for me, the start, like 2017, really looking more at like intersectionality and privilege. And I sort of understood intersectionality more through the lens of health, like social determinants of health and those kind of pieces there, but really seeing this other kind of social work, critical kind of like legal theory lens and broadening that. And in the meantime, what we had started seeing in the wellness center is people, you know, those microaggressions you're speaking about. So we have a lot of students from a lot of
hear the word microaggression and it gets me, I start feeling some sort of way.
Yes, exactly. So as we start the team, we have more of a wellness space. I mean, as we as a society too are learning more about the impacts of these things, right? Around like equity and things like that and just being, you know, human rights and then being a part of this Are You Down With AOP group. And then in the wellness center, like I said, seeing like the student leaders being like, oh, this student said this totally inappropriate comment. And it could have been about any group that may face oppression. And it's like, okay, how do we deal with this? So, you know, it was things like how to support the ambassadors to be the bystanders. I think that's really important. So how do you respond when someone says something that's completely inappropriate and racist or completely inappropriate and misogynistic or sexist? And so as you start embedding that in the training of the leaders, when the leaders feel more comfortable and confident to start speaking about these things, then we started, okay, like, why don't we focus on these things in a lot of our marketing materials and our health promotion materials? And so for example, we have theme months now over the last couple of years. It helps us kind of guide what types of outreach events and health promotion we focus on. Because as I said, wellness is everything. Trust me, I've been in this role long enough. Like everything is wellness. So how do we kind of titrate that down for what we can actually achieve and accomplish? And so for us, because the International Day to Eliminate Racial Discrimination is in March, we focus March on our equity. So we kind of really focus specifically on equity related issues to health in that month. But we do, as you mentioned, embed it in what we do. And I think also part of that is that I do, and in interviews with students who were asked, interviewing for the roles of student wellness ambassadors, we actually ask them questions about privilege. We ask them questions about equity, diversity, and inclusion and what an inclusive campus looks like to them. We ask them these questions to see like what their knowledge and literacy level is for themselves already. And we understand like not everyone's going to be at the same literacy level, but we also include it in our training. So actually one of the new things this year, which I'm really excited about, is that all of the leaders will be taking part in the Indigenous Canada course through U of A. And they have until, it's an online course. I'll be doing it as well. Sultan, who's our new wellness support specialist, will be doing it. So it's how do we help support the literacy level of our leaders? And I think when we talk about peers, right, peer-to-peer support, and we also use an equity lens in hiring students. So if we have peers here who can relate to other students in ways because of their, they have a similar cultural understanding, or, right, you know, you see someone because they look like you.
Right. The comfort level really.
Yeah.
Really, so like, difference, I think.
Yeah. And so the one group actually, which generally we don't see as an equity seeking or a, you know, a group to consider EDI, but is men. So as you know, in nursing, it's a predominantly gendered field, right? Predominantly female identified field.
Mostly. I feel like it's, I always find this a little interesting, but I feel like there's a lot of like girl power mantras in nursing where it's like, I feel like, I don't know, but it's strange because as women, I think we're so used to being alienated in workplaces and in educational fields. The moment I stepped into nursing and it was all like mostly women, or at least gendered women, it felt like this comfortable space where everybody understood your struggle. And I don't know, it was amazing. It was a funny shift. That was a great shift for me, but for any of the men in the program, I can definitely see that being a flip. So I just have to put that out there, that it's so interesting when suddenly you're the person who has that like privilege, like, because I was suddenly in a position where, because I've never had that before. I've never been like the racial majority, or I've never been like, you know, like the gender majority or any kind of majority before. I've always been the minority. It's like having that like female companionship of, I don't know, it was just so strange, but it was so cool for me to see that flip side.
I just think in terms of like in the wellness field, for example, we talked about mental health earlier, you talked about like, and mental health, absolutely, because that's like really foundational for a lot of things, our coping skills and abilities, right? When we manage, everyone's going to experience stress, but we look at, you know, like generally cisgendered men or men, male identified like students, for example, they don't necessarily access services to support their mental health at the same rate that maybe they're, if we're looking at like gendered female identified students would. So even in for wellness center leaders or ambassadors, you know, it's really hard to recruit men in, on our team. And so we do look at equity in terms of the hiring of our students. And I'm really, and I think that we should be looking at an equity lens, like of course, more broadly than just us hiring students on campus. And I think we're really working towards that. I'm really excited because Sultan, who we've hired to be our wellness support specialist, you know, he's a male. So I'm like, so it's not just another white woman working in the wellness center with me. You know, we have someone who's been a leader before and has experience and has had a different cultural background than myself. And right. So I'm really excited that we have now him working in the center as my colleague. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but anyways.
You know what? I really appreciate the fact that there's just a bunch of a diverse group of leaders, because even in myself being in this position that I am right now with, you know, podcasts and creating all these resources and everything, it's incredibly strange because I think part of that racial well-being aspect is not having access to the same opportunities. Mm-hmm. So for me, my parents are immigrants. I just recently figured out the fact that I guess I'm an immigrant too. Because I wasn't born here. It just, it was an epiphany to me because I had always like discussed, oh, I'm a first generation Canadian. I guess I'm not, but just that epiphany, there's like that part of like understanding that system. And so neither of my parents did their undergrads here. So I did not understand like the high school to university transition. Mm-hmm. I took every single science class and all like the really hard academic classes because I thought that was what's going to get me into university. And my peers were taking just like, you know, one science and one math and one English and like enjoying their high school time. And so that's kind of, I think it plays a lot into that wellness, mm-hmm. because it's understanding how you fit into the world and that identity piece, especially, which you've mentioned. The thing is that I think a lot of students that are minorities, it's really hard for you to figure out your identity when there's other people telling you what your identity is. Mm-hmm. Because for me, it's like, well, I'm a Muslim woman. I am significantly melanated, but I am more than that. You know, there's more aspects to me. And for people to put me in just like one small box, it impacts my well-being because it impacts the potential I see in myself and the kind of opportunities I have and the kind of opportunities available to me. Because oftentimes a lot of these things work off of, you know somebody who understands how something works, or they know somebody. And for international students, immigrants, we don't have that web of people that know people. So we can't get a foot in the door. And so I think it all adds up to this very large disparity in well-being, because say, I'll give the example of a high school student. So a high school student like me who immigrated here, even though I was like a year, a couple months old, my experience going from high school to university will be much, much more stressful because I don't understand anything. Nobody in my family's done this before. I'm figuring it out on my own, and I'm putting extra pressure because when you're like an immigrant or an internet, I'm not going to speak to the international student experience actually. So I'm going to loop that one in too. But for children of immigrants and immigrants, failure isn't really an option. Mm-hmm. There is no backup plan. The backup plan, you really can't go back to where, I know people like to say, go back to where you came from. You really can't, because you don't fit in there anymore. That's not what you're identifying as. So the failure is not an option is a huge part, because as we know, perfectionism leads to high anxiety situations. And it's the same with, you know, immigration and the way you have to work overtime to just be half as good. And I think that's all the aspects of student wellness, or just wellness in general as a whole concept, that get ignored. Because again, like you said, we look at it, it's like, are you eating enough? Are you sleeping? Are you doing all these things? But it's like this whole other boulder hiding under a rock that nobody's ever seen. So it makes me just like wonder, like, how do students balance that? And because I don't know, I'll be completely honest. And I don't think even anybody can figure out, at least at this point, how students can balance that. Again, should I copyright this term, racial wellness, how to achieve that, you know?
Well, you make an excellent point, Amna. And I think what we do know is a few things. So in terms of like student success and their wellness. So a couple of years ago, like probably 2019, because it's always a blur. As we mentioned, we think we're still in March 2020, but you know, there was a presentation done for us in student services, faculty of student development, about like what's happening in terms of mental health at like post-secondary level in kind of North America. So like there's a research group called EAB. I never remember what they stand for, because it's not actually EAB. Like there's no, the acronym doesn't actually explain it fully. Anyhow,
okay, I never know what acronym.
Okay, good. But EAB, if you were to look them up, they're like a research organization. A lot of post-secondaries employ them to kind of say, hey, we want to know information about this XYZ. And they will do it for you, and they will contact a bunch of other post-secondaries, see what they're doing. So they had this presentation that I attended about mental health. And what they said was recruitment, or like attendance, like so numbers of students attending post-secondary institutions in the past 5 years at that point had not really significantly changed. It was pretty much a flat as a pancake line in terms of growth. What they said, however, was that the need for mental health services had gone up 5 times in the last few years. So you're seeing the same number of students, but now like the rate of like needing mental health supports had increased fivefold. Things that they sort of spoke to and they kind of look at like that retention piece of students who are successful. They look at kind of retention as one measurement of success.
And this what does success mean in this context?
Pardon me?
What would
retention. So okay, it means that you went from first year to second year. You made it through.
Okay. I should know this now.
Okay. No, it's okay. So you made it from, and they were looking at first years. So first years who successfully transitioned to second year post-secondary. Okay. And what they said, they kind of found 4 main factors was a growth mindset, right? Rather than having a fixed mindset, you saw mistakes, or you saw failure as an opportunity to learn and grow. Okay. So that was one of the things. Grit. So that kind of like, I can do this, like that kind of like, I'm just going to keep going and plugging through. Resiliency. Now, resiliency is a thing I've been listening to a bit lately. And actually, I listened to a podcast, I think, with like Brene Brown and like
listening to other podcasts, Chelsea.
Yeah, really? Sorry.
Really, Chelsea? That's what you're
sorry,
doing?
Sorry, Amna. I, See, she might be afraid of you. You might be taking her like business because you're so awesome.
Oh no.
But just talking about like how resiliency actually itself is a privilege. That's another whole story, but like resiliency, building resiliency. And then also the last one, which you just mentioned was experience with failure. But you've said for many students, visible minorities or immigrants, you specifically spoke to like children of immigrants, yeah, or immigrants, is failure is not an option. However, if that is one of the four kind of underpinning skills or abilities, if those are kind of the four conditions or experience, right? Yeah, prerequisites for success. But if your family culture or your broader culture or your experience tells you it's not okay to fail, how does that leave the students in terms of success, in terms of that transition?
Right. And it makes you think a lot about like what we consider a high achieving student, mm-hmm, because like, would you consider me to be a high achieving student, or like, what's your prototype? And it makes you wonder, because for me, like I said, failure is not an option, regardless of how I'm feeling, how sad I am, how much racism is making me sad, which it does on a daily basis. You're not going to figure that out by just looking at my transcript or by looking at my student engagement, because like I said, failure is not an option, because what are you going to do? You don't just let yourself go like down, mm-hmm, you fall into that category where immigration is already such a hot topic, where everybody has an opinion and a lot of the opinions can be negative. If I'm not a professional, or if I'm not in a position that's secure, like I'm not a nurse, I'm not, again, like there's that thing, like why do immigrants become lawyers and doctors, and why is that a thing? Like why do they achieve more if there's so much racism, right? There's that counter argument, like, oh well, they're doing pretty well, like so much education. But the thing is that if you can't do that, if you're not that, then what are you? You're nothing, because people already have a negative view of you. Your quality of life is negligible compared to somebody else who may be white and dropped out of university. So that option doesn't exist. So like you said, like, is that an accurate measure of success? Because like I used to, just when I was in high school, I used to be super like, oh, why do immigrant parents keep telling everybody they have to be a lawyer, doctor, engineer? Like, why are there only three career choices? And a lot of my friends as well, they're like, oh, well, you know, brown parents, lawyer, doctor, engineer, there's three options. That's all. But you have to understand, that's because that's the only positions where you can work towards them and hopefully get them and then be respectable, because otherwise you're just another immigrant. You're nothing. And that, and being something and being secure in your position in this, in society, and being regarded as a valuable member of society, I think is a basic element to people feeling secure in their life position and having that health and well-being aspect. If you're feeling like you're expendable to society, or if you're just like an extra person taking up space, I'm not saying that's true, but that is going to make you feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of that, it's kind of a contingency plan. Like the backup plan to backup plan is just education. And so I really get mad or annoyed or just frustrated, I think I should say, when I hear people make that argument, like, oh, well, look at the people, or look at the proportions of people that are with medical degrees or lawyers or doctors, like, oh, all my doctors are brown, or they're immigrants, and this is that. It just angers me, because you're not understanding the context. Like, these people have had to succeed because there's no other option, and that success may be like what we're calling success, but what if they didn't want to be that? Well, like, what if I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to act on stage a lot. That was my thing. I love theater. But somebody asked me if I could, like, for a role, if I could take off my hijab, or if I could replace it with something. And that was the last audition that I went to. Mm-hmm. Like, not that I wasn't going to university, but I wanted to act on stage as well, part-time as a theater nerd. And so it's that the opportunities that exist for you are already narrow. So yes, they're going to get really good grades, and they're going to push hard, because that's the only option. And that's not a measure of their mental well-being at all.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. Exactly. And I think it's,
that was really long.
No, but that's, I mean, I'm just kind of just listening. Cause I'm like, I totally agree with you. And when you're, you know, the comments like, well, why shouldn't people of color be physicians and lawyers? Like, so like, you know what I mean? Like, of course, like anyone should have the opportunity to follow their passions and dreams in terms of what they want to do for their careers and in their lives. Right. So, and that was the interesting thing, Amna, like in terms of some of my learning, which was kind of aha moments, epiphanies, when I mentioned when I was in Nepal. There was four of us as students, and two of us got like kind of scholarships to go. And so we were both at the same hospital. We had a 3-year funded project with the Canadian, I think, Development, or CDAS, Canadian Development Agency, International Development Agency. And so we were in this hospital called, in Dulacel. And I mean, we should have a coffee chat about this, because it was such a fabulous experience. But one thing that really stuck with me there, and we had this sort of exchange program, where four of their nurses, so two each semester, nurses working in Dulacel Hospital would come. They were funded to come for a whole semester and take courses with us in third year and some fourth year probably. And then there was three groups. So 12 students from here. So each year were 3 years. And I was the last group who got to go to their hospital for 6 weeks for CP, like you mentioned CP. But what had happened kind of in the later, the third year for our year, was actually there was a university kind of built outside Dulacel, and they started a nursing program. And so we had a bit of a different experience than some of the two previous groups, because there were a lot of the nursing students were in the clinical care setting in the hospital. And so actually it benefited me, because I got lots of different cool things, which I never would have got to do here in Canada. So I was super grateful for that. But what it was interesting was we did some common sit downs, lessons, chatting with the students, learning from them, talking about what it was like to be a nursing student. And it's so interesting, because I was we had so many of the same worries, concerns about being a nursing student. And I remember some of the students saying, well, when I make a mistake and my nursing instructor calls me out in front of the patient, they no longer trust me.
Yeah, I get that.
And I don't and I'm like, oh, I would hate that. And it really created a really nice moment between us in terms of the empathy and understanding. But you're nursing students in Nepal have some of the same, well, they're facing very different levels of healthcare, in terms of access and things like that.
But at the base of it, we're all we all have the same worries and stresses. The
foundation of it, I was I would hate that too. And it just really created, like you said, that understanding and empathy. And I'll never forget that in my whole life, because that was really an aha moment for me in terms of, we're different, but we're also very similar, in terms of some of those factors. So you're right. And I see you and I hear you as a person who, has to experience these horrible things, and you shouldn't have to. I think, it's just, it makes me angry and it makes me mad.
I like that you bring up the nursing student thing, because I think in Kamloops, at least, being a nursing student gives you a little bit of credibility to exist. And at least I found that, it's interesting, because I just want to add on to what I was saying before about having a credential as a brown or black or Indigenous person makes you more valuable to society and less expendable. Because I have been in situations over the last year since I've started nursing where before I disclose that I'm a nursing student, I'll have people be really dismissive of me, or I can feel those microaggressions, because when you are a racialized person, you have that radar all the time. It's always going. Mm-hmm. And you can tell. And if nobody else can tell, it's I've stopped worrying about if anyone else can tell, because I can tell. And it's when women kind of have that feeling with sexual violence, it's kind of you have a little inkling. It's the same thing, essentially.
You have a radar, internal navigation system
exactly the same thing. And then the moment, I'll kind of use being a nursing student as a defense or justification for why I should be regarded as a equal member of society. So I'll go, oh yeah, I'm just picking this up for nursing, I'm so tired. I was in clinical really late last night. Or I had to wake up really early, or I'll bridge that into the conversation, not in the way that people that go to Harvard say they went to Harvard, not at all. That's not what we're doing, but I'll just nudge that in, and it'll I kind of do it as a social experiment, and it completely changes the tone. And it's suddenly I become somebody who's worthy of being a customer or worthy of being there. And so it makes me think about how students who are navigating the professional world for the first time. I know when I started working as a storyteller with Alicia Ashcroft, I've grown so much since then, because that was my first kind of foray into the professional world. And one of my worries was that, will I be regarded as an equally valuable member? And it's an amazing environment and super supportive. I'd highly recommend people to be a storyteller at some point. My low expectations weren't necessary. They were above and beyond. Everything was amazing. But that's still a worry that students would have. And again, that's a mental health challenge, right? Because what is mental health? Is it like looking at like the WHO's definition of health and well-being? I would say that having that ability to function in society, regardless of your race, gender, creed, mm-hmm. etc., being an obstacle, that's part of health and well-being.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think that's the thing. I think when the one thing I think to me that's foundational into health and wellness, and you've kind of really alluded to it, is a sense of belonging.
Exactly.
And feeling like you can be your true authentic self in the places and spaces that you are and occupy. And that, you know, we did a sense of belonging survey in 2018, yeah. I believe. So in student development, we were looking at strategic priorities and, you know, health and wellness, communications was one, indigenization, and one was sense of belonging. Because what we found was very interesting from surveys that students had done. TRU always scores super high, like nationally, as well as compared to like our kind of comparator university. So ones we think are similar to us. And then also nationally, in terms of our faculty student contact, people have a lot of positive things to say about that connection between faculty. Because we're smaller, you have more access probably to talk to your instructors. I think of myself, I went to UBC and did a science degree, and I came here and did nursing. And wow, that's a whole podcast on different experiences for sure. But then when we looked at sense of belonging, we weren't as high, as positive as we thought compared to those other institutions that are like us. And nationally, we're like, what is going on? And so I actually work with a group of third year nursing students. And so I was sort of taking a lead on this of the sense of belonging kind of group out of FSD, Faculty of Student Development acronym. And we looked at factors that contribute to sense of belonging. And so we created a survey, and it was actually amazing because we didn't really promote it. You know, it's kind of the end of March, your health promotion project is ending. And at the time, Christine Adam, our AVP students and Dean sent it out. And we had, I think, 790 responses, something like that. And what we found was racism had a huge impact on students' sense of belonging.
Of course.
And right. And so the spaces and places. And so we read, there was we did a lot of qualitative pieces there. And so that's for me in terms of, like you mentioned, like the kind of things that need to be embedded. And for me in wellness is that students feel like they belong, is that when they come in our space, when they talk to us at a table in our outreach, when they come to our workshop, when they speak to a leader, when they speak to me, they feel like they belong. They don't feel judged. They feel accepted for who they are and where they're at. And we're here so that students feel good about themselves so they can succeed. And so when they go out, you know, when they graduate and they take on a new career and potentially, maybe not everyone wants a family, but like have relationships in their life, that they have a sense of like what it feels like to be belonging, and that they can recreate that like in the spaces and places that they go. You know, one of the things that specifically we've done, it's for kind of a, you know, an underserved group, is unfortunately just before COVID and like kind of winter semester 2020, we started a queer connections group for our 2S LGBTQ plus students. I worked alongside students who identify in that community to create that. So I am a white cisgendered woman who is heterosexual. So I am like not, you know what I'm saying? So I'm just going to be out there. I'm very privileged. And so I'm not going to be this person who is going to be dictating what types of programs we should, you know, like I'm passionate about this work. And that's why I think we've been doing it. But I also like partner and rely on those connections and relationships that I build with students and other members of our campus and Kamloops community in order to help be co-creators in what we do. So it was really, I worked with three students. Two were human service students who had attended one of our workshops that was directed for 2S LGBTQ plus students around sexual health, and one who was on the True Sue Pride group. And we said, what can we do? And I said, you know what, it was kind of November, I'm like, come see me in January. They did. And then we actually just met this week to see how we can get this up and running again for September. So having, you know, students who identify and have the experience and knowledge and expertise. Like, we can't forget, students have a lot of expertise, and we know this from nursing, and people are the experts of themselves, right? I also just want to say that's why I think, you know, I'm hoping why, and we hope that people feel like they belong here, is because we have a diverse perspective and we're supporting and offering safe spaces for people to come and feel safe. But I just want to mention that because I think it's really important that it's not just me as the wellness coordinator who is dictating this work. It is a collaboration between, you know, many different stakeholders on campus and the community that really help. And we wouldn't be able to do good work without that.
But at the same time, I think what you're doing is really important. It can be a little strange welcoming white people into places where minorities are trying to make change, because it can be a little scary because, like, oh, are you going to come take over everything? But at the same time, it's, I think everybody, even like people of color, need to understand that to make change, we need white people on board. And white people need to be the ones that are really, really, really working hard, because someone who already doesn't value me because of my skin color isn't going to listen to me. They might listen to you, mm-hmm. right? Like you might be more credible to them. Well, probably are more credible to them than I am. So it's just really important to always remember the importance of partnership. In closing, I want to ask just one last question. What recommendation do you have for like wellness for students who are experiencing that, like, anxiety or stress around racism? Because just like, I know it might not be something that you feel you can talk on, but at the same time, I think because you are, you know, a wellness coordinator, nurse, like if you have a perspective on, you know, what can help, because I'm always anxious about racism. What can I do?
I was going to say, can I ask you a question, Amna, like in terms of like, what do you find works to support you? Have you found something that works for you when you're feeling anxious or you've experienced? That's what I have curiosity about that, because like, I've never experienced racism firsthand myself. So I could support you in terms of referring you to resources or maybe strategies in terms of general, if you're feeling anxious. So being in nursing is kind of a funny story. When I got my first job working in, I started in, like as a casual, then I went out to, you know, Ashcroft. I was based out of Ashcroft and kind of was in that community there. And it's like, people talk about, can you teach or support someone through breastfeeding if you've never done it? Let me tell you, breastfeeding is one of the hardest things I had to do with my first child. It was not easy. And so after I had that experience, I could definitely relate a whole lot better because I'd lived it myself. However, I still could help support that mom through breastfeeding based on some of the knowledge and resources I had around what has been worked for other people in the past or who they could access who were, you know, lactation consultants, or support them through any myths that they may have read or thought about. So it's kind of, and this is, I'm not talking like racism and breastfeeding are the same thing, but
I completely get it. Yeah.
Right. You get what I'm kind of reaching at here is that I haven't experienced it. So if a student say were to come to me and they were experiencing that, I would be there to listen. Once again, it's terms like they're the expert of their own experience. I would talk, you know, kind of using a motivational interviewing framework by asking what would they like to see? Are they okay if I share some resources that may be helpful? Within our own faculty, I will highlight for your listeners if they've stayed on this long and listened to me ramble on, but
it's mostly me I'm worried about that. They're going to exit out because I start on a tangent.
I go on tangents. I've learned a lot from you just in this conversation. But something that I think, a couple things for you to know about. One is that I'm really excited because we haven't hired two Indigenous counselors. We got extra funding this year. Yay. We are currently looking to hire, and I think we have some applications, it's advertised. And then once again, like you mentioned terminology of people or like how to refer to like populations or groups of people. It's like, I don't know, because Kyra say, well, if you say someone's racialized, well, who's racializing that person, yeah. Right? So it's like, I think these are the sticky points that were the murky middle that we're kind of all trying to figure out. But I will say, we are in the process of have a posting for hiring a counselor who is a visible minority. So what we've all heard, a Black Indigenous person of color is kind of what I think is like a United States kind of grouping of like identification. But once again, it's like I said, the murky middle of what to say.
We get like the overview though, I think regardless of the exact word we use, I think it's like,
right. So we're looking to hire people who, you know, that others, you know, students who experience
people.
who may experience racism can have that commonality or common experience, you know, can and get it. So I'm really excited about that. I think that's going to be really transformational for the services we can provide on campus. I'm just in the middle, and so this isn't guaranteed, but I've been working hard with Cindy James, and then Christine Adam has also been like a liaison. We've been working on a grant for Bell Let's Talk. They have grants for post-secondaries. And this one, we're really focusing on targeted approaches for underserved students and you know, recognizing Black, Indigenous students of color in terms of mental health support. And so hopefully we get this money and then we can help support students in these areas a bit better. And I think part of that is like increasing people's literacy about racism, about health and about mental health. And so that really for me is why I love nursing and I'm passionate about health promotion, because knowledge is power. When you have the knowledge and literacy, you can make more informed decisions and you can hopefully shift your practice, your behavior, to increase that cultural safety, you know, to increase that understanding and literacy about what it might, what racism is and how people experience it and hearing people's stories. That's why I love that you're a storyteller. I'm very committed. Like when you hear someone's story, that's really what resonates with me. So there are some things also positively moving, but I'm not really answering your question, but I think it's okay. A hard question to answer.
I know. And you know? I'm guilty of it too, because like, well, I ask you, but it's like, am I sure what to do? A lot of times I just go and nap. Because if you're asleep, it doesn't exist. It's my philosophy. But sometimes that's what you need. And I think it's okay to acknowledge the fact that sometimes we don't have all the answers and I don't have all the answers.
Exactly. Either. And that's, in terms of that, Amna, in terms of being a nurse, that's the one thing I learned very from the get-go is if you don't know, don't try to answer and make something up. Exactly. You just acknowledge, I don't know. And I think what I've learned in my 18 years as a nurse, and prior to that, in working in residence at UBC and just being a person, is that at the end of the day, people just want to know that they've been listened to, that they feel valued. I can't solve anyone's problems or concerns or like, you know, these systemic things. It's like we all together, like you said, need to work collaboratively to like broadly, you know, try to dismantle racism. But I think at the individual level, like I will do my best so that when a student is with me, they feel listened to and heard and valued, and that, you know, what they're going through is real for them, and that I can offer to support them in the ways that they feel is best suits them.
And Chelsea, I think that's the most important thing, is just listening and learning. And I've really appreciated listening to you and hearing you speak today. It's been a blast. And
thank you, Emma. You
better have some Earl Grey tea in the wellness.
I know.
It's my requirement. Okay.
And I think I did a tea shop, so we'll see. We're getting all prepared.
Earl Grey and the one with lavender in it. It's my requirement.
Ooh, okay. Well, we'll see. Okay. We'll see. But thank you. It's been a pleasure. And like I said, every time I speak with you, I learn something. So I want to thank you for your open, this authentic conversation and your honesty about like your experiences. And it's gonna take a lot of conversation and reflection and action to make change.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amna.
You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website i-on-edi.tierubox.ca.